Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Jim Fallows, who is the national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. Jim, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much, Harry. It's nice to be back here again.
So let's talk a little about the way the U.S. has responded to the events of 9/11. How would you characterize the overall response of the Bush administration?
Well, I think before giving my own opinion, I should say from the Bush administration's point of view, you're exactly right in saying that everything since September 11th of 2001 has been of a piece from their point of view. First war in Afghanistan, then war in Iraq, then the network of sort of domestic activities. So if you believe, as the Bush administration does, that going to war in Iraq was the way to get to the root of the problem, then what they've done makes sense. If you don't believe that the war of Iraq helps in that cause and, in fact, is a distraction or worse, as I do, as I think it was the wrong approach, then you think there's been a huge strategic gamble by this administration, which one hopes will turn out well but might turn out quite badly.
So let's break that apart. What do you think they got right, if anything?
Well, certainly, I think many people should have, or at least I did, admire President Bush's stance in the immediate aftermath of the September 11th attacks, where he gave the best speech of his career, one of the best speeches of any president, on September 20th, 2001, when he went to the Congress and spoke about how, you know, we needed to pull together as Americans, and this wasn't a war against Muslims individually. It was a war for freedom and justice and all that sort of thing. And I think there, in the immediate aftermath of the attack, he struck the right tone. Second, I think in going to Afghanistan, really the only dispute is how long it took to get there. That everybody realizes that's where the base for Al-Qaeda was, and that where the Taliban was supporting them. The question is after that, and essentially you can look at that. So they were right in the initial tone and going to Afghanistan. After that, the problem is the things that weren't done and the things that were. The things that weren't done, for example, were a different approach to energy. So the U.S. was not so hostage to what happens in Saudi Arabia. A different approach to the Middle East standoff. So we weren't so hostage to the PLO-Israeli situation. A request for shared sacrifice, which didn't come. So that it's, you know, just now it's just the people in the military bearing the brunt. And so everything else sort of took second place to preparing for war in Iraq. And I think that's the crux of it. If you believe, as the president does, that was the heart of it, it's right. If you don't, then you think that was a huge missed opportunity.
And they really compromised our position in Afghanistan by rushing to the next war.
Yes. There's incidental, by which I don't mean it's small, I mean it relates to an incident, the fact that at a time when there could have been pressure to kind of close the noose on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in particular during the Battle of Tora Bora, that's when already the center of gravity was starting to shift towards preparations for Iraq. And I interviewed a lot of military people immediately after that, and they talked about how the special forces troops, the NSA satellites, the linguists who were expert in languages of that region were beginning already to be sort of shifted towards preparations for Iraq. And also, the pressure was not put on either Pakistan or Saudi Arabia at that time to really, really help out crushing Al-Qaeda, because both of them were necessary for the preparations for Iraq. So that's when there began to be the trade-off, where Osama bin Laden was less and less the target, and Saddam Hussein was more and more the target.
Is there a simple explanation of why they decided to go after Iraq? We know that they've given a lot of reasons. The reasons have changed over time. But the bottom line seems that they wanted to get Saddam, and they perceived a threat which harkened back to an earlier period, namely the 90s, when if you had terrorists, they were mentored or being sponsored by a rogue state.
You said, is there a simple reason or a real reason? I think what's fascinating about this is I don't think there is a simple reason. Mm-hmm. I think it wouldn't have happened the way it did. It couldn't have happened the way it did were it not for about 25 different parts all lining up in alignment. You know, for example, you had the same cast of characters who'd fought Saddam Hussein the first time in the first Bush administration all back. from the second Bush administration. You had the perception, for whatever reason, there was a threat for WMD. You had the personal factor of the president, whose father had been threatened with assassination by Saddam Hussein. And I think, and this I think was the most powerful reason, you had the argument developed during the 1990s by Paul Wolfowitz and others that in the long run, if you wanted really to have peace in the world, you had to sort of clean up the whole Arab situation, the Arab-Islamic world, and you had to make a good example of Iraq. So I think that what we're now hearing after the war as the justification, I think, was the strongest single one before the war, too. It's just not what they told us.
What distinguishes this leadership group from what has come before? You served in the Carter administration as a speechwriter. There seems to be something qualitatively different. Is that a correct perception?
To my mind, this does seem to be an unusual administration, and I do think the biggest difference from past pattern is that the very top two or perhaps top three positions. We have a strong Secretary of Defense now, or we've had with Secretary Rumsfeld, but there have been strong Secretaries of Defense before, for example, Robert McNamara. He was matched with a strong but losing Secretary of State, Colin Powell, et cetera. I think the real difference had been the dynamic among the President, the Vice President, and the National Security Advisor. President Bush, from what one can tell from a distance, is a man of sort of great self-confidence and willingness to take big sort of risks in life, to make big dramatic gestures, but who has virtually no curiosity about the details of certain cases. He seems to view the executive's responsibility as making big yes, no, one or 100 type decisions, and things that are more detailed than that are for the underlings. They're to be delegated. Now, you can see what he's reacting against in the case either of Jimmy Carter, my one-time employer, who would famously assign the White House tennis courts or look at the thrust-to-weight charts of the B-1 bomber, so that he didn't want to be in that category, nor Bill Clinton, who would stay up all night talking about the details of this or that policy. The president, President Bush, clearly views it as a strength to say, we're going this way, and let's not think about all the little minutiae. When that is combined with a situation that is dense, tangled, unpredictable, with hundreds of years of history in it, it leaves one prone to some radical misjudgments of the circumstance, not simply on the pre-war intelligence about weapons of mass destruction, but also the sense of how would a country like Iraq respond to a foreign occupation force. So you have a president who doesn't care about details. You have a vice president who's taken on a very sort of dark view of the world, so far as one can tell from his speeches. I should say that when I worked for Jimmy Carter, we followed the Ford administration. Dick Cheney had been Gerald Ford's chief of staff. He was the main transition person. There couldn't have been a more bipartisan, open-minded, non-vindictive type of person than the Dick Cheney of that period, but that seems different. The third person in the mix, in my view, is Condoleezza Rice in her role as National Security Advisor. Personally, very, very close to President Bush, and seemingly unwilling to do two things that had been the heart of that job in the past. One is making sure the president has the whole range of information that he might need to make a decision. The other is reconciling differences between the departments. Neither of those happened, and so President Bush's apparent preference to know only the big choice and none of the details had no kind of corrective from his national security advisor.
In one of your pieces, and I should mention to our audience that it's worth going back and looking at the pieces that you've written for the Atlantic Monthly since 9/11. One of the points you make in one of those pieces that looking at defenders of the Iraq war before the war, there was an emphasis not on what the future might look like, but rather on the past, and using cases, for example, like Japan and Germany, which any comparative analysis would say, this isn't the same thing. Talk a little about that.
Well, one of the articles I did that I found actually very fascinating to do, this was in the summer of 2002, that is, during the buildup towards the war in Iraq. I did an article for The Atlantic, which we published as the 51st state. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to talk to people who've been involved in past occupations and say, assuming we go to war, and assuming we win the military part of the battle, very easily, what happens then? What can we expect? And there was a huge amount of lore and advice that turned out to be accurate about what would happen in Iraq. But one interesting strand was how very, very different this experience was likely to be either than Germany or Japan, you know, the two great past occupations, because they'd been beaten in total war. It was a whole, you know, they were just very different societies from what Iraq was going to be. But there seemed to be within the administration an unwillingness to look much past Germany and Japan. Say, well, it worked there, it'll work here too. And of course, there was no insurrection in either Germany or Japan after World War II, because mm-hmm. they were thoroughly beaten mm-hmm. countries after, you know, 4 years of total war, or more than 4 years. So I think there was, at the working level of the administration, there was a very careful and very successful effort to anticipate what sorts of challenges the United States might face in Iraq. And we can go into detail if you'd like. At the very top level, mm-hmm. the president, the vice president, the secretaries of the departments, there seems to have been either a deliberate or an inadvertent refusal to pay attention to any of that, and therefore being caught by surprise when things started to be difficult in the occupation.
And talking now along this line, from one of your pieces, it's very clear that the government was doing a pretty good job yeah. about thinking of where we were going and what the consequences would be. And the key here is that they were cut out from the decision-making process.
Yes. Let me give you first an anecdote and then the background theory. The anecdote is Jay Garner was, of course, the first American viceroy in Baghdad after the fall of Baghdad. And he heard about a man named Thomas Warwick. And Thomas Warwick was a State Department professional who, for the previous 2 years, had been supervising this thing called the Future of Iraq Project, which was this vast, dozens of volume type study, mainly by Iraqi exiles, of what to expect in the petroleum industry or what to expect with the justice system. And Thomas Warwick was the director of this whole project. So Jay Garner hired him for his team to work in the occupation. And they got a phone call from Donald Rumsfeld saying, you have to fire Thomas Warwick. And Garner told me, what are you talking about? You know, this man has been supervising our effort. And Rumsfeld told him, my orders come from high enough that I cannot question them, which must mean either the president or the vice president. So there was some willful decision mm-hmm. from the highest level of the government not to take advantage of this report, which Garner was also told not to read. Mm-hmm. And so the larger point is there was a huge amount of effort in the State Department, the CIA, the Army War College, the Army itself, the Marine Corps, to say, here's what we have to prepare for. But essentially, all that was just wasted because it didn't connect to the actual policy machine.
And the story here is that in the 90s, the American government learned a lot. The military learned a lot. The State Department learned a lot after dealing with going from a disaster like Somalia yeah. to places like Bosnia mm-hmm. and Kosovo. So there was a learning curve going on. But all of that was really brushed aside. Now, why do you think that was? I mean, one point I think that you touch upon somewhere is the notion that they didn't want the dissent about the course of action that they were taking. And
yes.
so it was part of the momentum and the logic of their imposing this decision on a democratic political system.
Right. I mentioned earlier that I thought, you know, the war in Iraq couldn't have happened unless all the stars came into alignment. And something similar is the case with sort of throwing away all the pre-war preparation. In terms of public discussion before the war, the administration, I guess understandably, didn't want a lot of focus on how hard it would be to occupy the country afterwards, because each time you discussed that, you sort of weakened the enthusiasm for going to war. If you said, yeah, we need to go to war, but suddenly we're going to be in charge of this country. That's for the external discussion. Internally, there seemed to be other factors. One was a lot of the lessons of the 90s, by definition, were Clinton administration lessons, mm-hmm. especially the Balkans and Somalia, too. And there was a sense, these Clinton people, it's the fact that they were weak and they were indecisive that made them have their problems. So we're not going to learn much from that. There was also a kind of argument being given the administration, the Bush administration, by Mr. Chalabi and some others in his group saying that, look, this is going to work well. It's going to be like the fall of the Soviet, it's going to be like the Czech Republic after the disappearance of the Soviet Union. Get rid of the Soviets and then things will be fine. Mm-hmm. And it'll be not a big problem. Iraq is a well-trained place. It's potentially rich. So there was that. There was, I think, probably genuine belief. Again, Paul Wolfowitz, number two in the Defense Department, had been heavily involved in the 1980s in Asia with bringing democratizing movements to the Philippines and Korea and elsewhere. So his belief was you give people a chance at democracy and basically things start going well as opposed to start going poorly. And sort of every force was pushing towards saying, well, let's not look at the bad side here. We need to do this because of WMD. It'll be good to do it and things will work out. There was a sense that things would go well rather than poorly.
And you make a point somewhere that it was there was also among the Republicans a sense of triumphalism that was their reading of the history of the Reagan administration and bringing the Iron Curtain down.
Yes. A lot of the people in the Bush administration, I mean, it's interesting the long pedigree of the people now in the second Bush administration. They worked together, many of them, in the Ford administration. Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and some of Kenneth Edelman, others were working in the Ford administration and sort of had descended from that time. What they learned from the Reagan years was sort of, they learned two interesting lessons from the Reagan years. One was the importance of the big, controversial, dramatic gesture. Proposing the Star Wars SDI initiative, putting theater missiles in Europe, having the sort of the Iceland summit with Gorbachev. Those were big gestures by Reagan to sort of shake up how things were configured. And in the mind of these people, they all worked well. So that was one thing that they got. The second lesson they took from the Reagan years is that both the Europeans and the domestic Democratic opponents would cry and whine and stamp their feet and wring their hands, but in the long run, they would bow to strength. You know, when they saw that these things worked, they would come along. And so there was almost a predisposition to say, if the Europeans are whining, and they would put it that in that way, whining as opposed to protesting, that's a sign that actually we're on the right course. And so if you place the mental picture being partly Ronald Reagan, partly Winston Churchill, jaunty, confident, assertive, going the right direction. I think that was the inner picture that the Bush administration was having.
Now, they were able to act in the context of what seemed to be a collapse by the opposition party. What is your analysis there? Is that a correct description? And what are the factors? Were the Democrats still fighting the Vietnam War?
Partly, I think, yes, they were, and I think that's part of the problem. Just as an observed kind of market failure, in the year before the war, public opinion polls always showed that the public had more doubts about this war than the Democratic Party did in Congress. That is, the Democratic Party, the opposition party, wasn't fully representing the opposition that was there in the public. So the question is, why? One theory would be the Democratic Party in Congress was more far-seeing, more public-spirited than the public, and that would be one explanation. Other explanations would be, first, Democrats, ever since the Vietnam years, have been just chronically fearful of seeming weak on defense. You know, this is their great vulnerability. The way they can always be sort of mau-mau'd is making them seem weak on defense. Another factor, a related factor, is that in the fall of 2002, August and September of 2002, when the crucial votes about going to war in Iraq were being taken, the Democrats in Congress deliberately decided not to oppose the administration. And the reason was they thought in the upcoming midterm elections, they would look weaker if they opposed the administration on this, and if they got this issue out of the way, they'd be able to talk about medical care and job loss and things which they thought of as their issues. It was a crass and stupid decision because they were not able to oppose the administration and they lost big in the midterms anyway. That's the part that makes it stupid.
I have a question about the structure of our government that we had always hoped that the division of the powers would give us a check and a balance system that would prevent something like the wrong war at the wrong time in the wrong place. But when you look at the record of the Congress in the Democratic years, it was when Clinton was president that the and he signed the regime change law with regard to Iraq. And one wonders whether that in reaching for consensus, that everybody kind of buys into the middle, which makes you vulnerable if somebody wants to move away from the middle and take an action based on that legislation.
I think that's a very fair and shrewd reading of things. It's part of the Democrats' sort of long-term national security problem. It's also part of something that happened in the build-up to the Iraq War. I mean, we all now know the WMD fears were completely false and exaggerated, and many people suspected that ahead of time, and many people like me were writing that. But in the build-up to a war, if the administration says, you know, if you knew what we knew, you'd understand how dire the threat was, that's a very, very difficult thing for elected leaders to resist, because how can they really stand up to it? They can say, you know, we don't think it's right, but in the end, I think you have to expect congressional people to bow to that argument. You can't use it twice for boy who cried wolf reasons, but the administration used it once and it had an effect.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about the press. You've written about the press. Its performance in the build-up to the war was not outstanding. Was the press being patriotic or what?
The press situation was fascinating for a variety of reasons. Again, it's a whole bunch of circumstances that just happened to come together in a particular alignment. One of those circumstances was that the attacks of September 11th were in the two centers of the press, New York and Washington. Mm-hmm. And the effect in New York was profound, because you had a lot of the normally liberal New York media establishment made understandably hawkish by the fact that they had been attacked. Mm-hmm. And the sort of culmination of this was the New Yorker magazine, the week before the war began, ran an editorial essentially saying, let's go to war. Mm-hmm. Something you would not have seen in the Vietnam era, you wouldn't have seen in any other era, but it was because New York had been attacked. So the New York establishment was much less dovish than it would have been. The Washington establishment, the minor factor was an attack in Washington. You know, it wasn't as bad as the one in New York, obviously. The major factor was a feeling starting in September of 2001 of Washington as sort of imperial war capital. It was really a powerful, powerful atmosphere there. And if you weren't kind of with the program of saying there's business to be done, we have to go clean their clocks in Iraq, you were not really a participant. You weren't really a man. You know, you weren't really playing ball with the big guys. And so both New York and Washington were sort of militarized in a way they weren't otherwise. And the press, for one reason or another, didn't feel as if it could challenge as directly as it should, you know, the case for war. There's lots of sort of incidental reasons, but the bottom line is, as you were saying, it wasn't engaged to really expose these arguments to scrutiny.
What about the larger media environment? Has there been a ratcheting up of the failure of the media? I'm now talking about things like CNN and Fox News and so on, where we're bombarded with all of these images. And it's almost like a preview of the coming war or something, making the war an exciting movie.
Well, let me give you my unified field theory in 30 seconds on this point. What's interesting to me about the change in the media during my time and working in it, which is to say the last 30 years, is that it's gone through a really important and simple transition. The transition is from being a very unusual kind of business to just a business. Mm-hmm. And there was a time when the media was like, say, law or medicine. It was a business, but not really. There was some kind of larger function it was supposed to play. Now it's just a business. And that means that at certain ends, it's very good. You know, there's high-end media that's very good. But the mass media really can't survive unless they can command your attention minute by minute. So on cable news in particular, whatever is the spectacle of the moment, whether it's, you know, O.J. Simpson or Princess Diana being killed or a war, they're all sort of the same. You know, they're all a spectacle.
Almost entertainment.
Yes, I mean, it's something that will just command the attention, because that's what they need to do to survive. You see this on local TV news especially. And so there is a kind of natural bias of TV news in particular for the next spectacle, and a war trumps almost anything, including O.J. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a predisposition, and you know, the embedded reporters in the war, that was very, very interesting to see. So it also means there's less foreign coverage, because it's very, very expensive to do, and only a few high-end publications can afford it anymore.
And especially in the period before 9/11, there wasn't a virtue that you always have demonstrated in your work, as if you were covering something, you go out and study it, as you did in Asia. And that was not the case here.
Well, again, it's if you think that that we're going to get the news the market provides now is sort of high-end specialized publications for a few, but most mainstream TV, the more time reporters spend learning about something, the more it costs. You know, if you're stationing somebody in Beijing or in Jakarta or wherever, that's expensive. And so the natural force of things means there's less and less of that and more just kind of, you know, cable talk shows where people have opinions on each subject that comes up, whether or not they've spent any time looking into it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the new media can contribute to our insights here, or will they become part of the problem?
I think both of those things. I think that there are parts of the new media. The new media contribute to the fact this is simultaneously the best and the worst time for media. It's best in the sense that if you want to, you can find out more information now than anybody before in history could. You know, you can read daily newspapers from Baghdad. You can read translated versions of the Saudi Arabian press, all the stuff nobody could have done 10 years ago. So that's great. And bloggers and sort of independent journalists fit in that because it's easier for somebody who happens to know about a particular subject to get his or her views heard than ever before. But also, there's more of a kind of just chorus of people saying, doing the equivalent of cable news talk shows, of having opinions about X, Y, and Z. So it's both better and worse at the same time.
You're a person who knows quite a bit about technology, written quite a bit. You know quite a bit also about the Defense Department. You had a book, one of your first books, on national defense. Let's talk a little about the implications of technology for foreign policy, especially as it relates to our military capabilities on the one hand, but also the capabilities that are become available to the other side, the terrorists.
Right. Yes. Let's talk first about our military, then we can talk about terrorists for a moment. It's interesting that April 3rd or 4th of 2003 marked, in a sense, a watershed in how Americans talked about technology in the military. Up until that point, for the previous decade or more, the idea had been this revolution in military affairs. The precision bombing the U.S. had, these standoff weapons, the fact that you could fly B-2 bombers from Missouri and have them drop bombs in Baghdad, it seemed as if there'd be no challenge to the U.S. because nobody could match this sort of precision, and the wars could be clean, surgical, and quick with basically no casualties on our side. After April 3rd or 4th, when Baghdad fell, and suddenly it didn't work so great anymore. And it was people with these grenades and hiding bombs and the carcasses of dead dogs and things like that. Our precision weapons weren't really that significant. It became the old military techniques of surprise and guile and looking for your enemy's weakness and all that. And so I think you hear much, much less of this technological triumphalism in the military and more discussion of, in the long run, what's the balance of strengths and weaknesses that the U.S. has and its enemies. And then to shift to the terrorists for a moment, the U.S., the technological projection of ability we have also exposes us in countless ways, from the cyber infrastructure of bringing things down that way, the electric grid, any kind of power supply, the openness of our society. And so I think people have a much more sober view after the fall of Baghdad than they did before of how technology makes us more powerful in some ways, but more vulnerable in countless other ways, too, towards a very low-tech but cunning enemy.
Now, with regard to the technology's impact on the military, technology, we have a history of trying to find a quick fix with technology as we're confronting different adversaries. And one senses that there is something going on here, namely that a soldier with a computer on the battlefield can target a bomb that's coming from a huge plane that's coming, God only knows where it's coming from, on the one hand. But on the other hand, when we are successful in particular cases, other things are going on. So although we were doing this in Afghanistan, there was other things going on. We had the support of the Northern Alliance. The tenant was unloading trunkfuls of dollar bills to pay these people off. Yes. So there is always a complex milieu in which the virtues of this technology are kind of misunderstood.
Let me give you the anecdote which always makes this dramatic to me. You know, the U.S. puts lots of emphasis onto having the best fighter planes in the world, and we have all these refined debates. Is the F-22 necessary or not? Or is the F-15 still okay? Or is the Joint Strike Fighter the right way to do it? The fact is, nobody will fight us in air-to-air battles anymore. I think the last air-to-air battle a U.S. plane was in was maybe over Libya about 15 years ago. I mean, it's been some very long period of time. Mm-hmm. People simply will not engage the U.S. Air Force because they will lose. And that doesn't mean they bow to American will in all forms. It means they find some other way of engaging U.S. power. More generally, whenever there is a conventional war to fight, like that three-week war for Iraq, the U.S. will win. But that means more and more adversaries will not engage us conventionally. They'll look for all the other ways where the strengths we have don't apply, and that's basically the problem the U.S. has now.
And is Rumsfeld doing a good job in this regard in terms of bringing this new technology and changing the military so it can deal with these different kinds of situations, or is he failing there also?
I personally have a sort of Jekyll and Hyde view of Rumsfeld's tenure at the Pentagon. On the one hand, before September 11th and after, to a degree, too, he was pushing very hard for what he viewed as the right kind of evolution of military machinery, military doctrine, of not having heavy, ponderous forces, of canceling some weapons that seemed to be old-fashioned and out of date. On the other hand, he seemed to be so carried away by that theory that he let it lead to some really catastrophic errors in the management of the Iraq war, in my view. Mm-hmm. I think one reason the occupation in Iraq has been so difficult is that Rumsfeld was insistent by doctrine on having a very small force to invade. That was enough to beat Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. It was not enough to occupy the country. And so I think he will be seen in a way like Robert McNamara, as somebody whose theory got in the way of doing a practical, good job. His theory, I think, was right in many ways, but wrong for the execution of this war.
And the military understood this very early on, because they had acquired, and the U.S. government had acquired, a body of experience with how you stabilize a post-conflict operation.
Yes, I think the most prescient-seeming document before the war, for after the war, was something put together by the Army War College in the fall of 2002. And it was an elegant document. It had sort of three parts. First was going through everything we'd learned from past occupations. It didn't talk about Southern Reconstruction after the Civil War, but it was sort of everything from the Philippines onward. Second was everything we could figure out about Iraq, you know, and what would be special there. And the third was this big grid of what you would have to worry about on day one, and on week one, and on month one. And it stood up very well. And part of its argument was you needed many, many, many more people to occupy the country than you did to conquer it. You know, conquering it would be easy, occupying it would be hard. So you could argue that that was part of the old mentality of the Army of throwing man into problem, but in hindsight, you know, that was right, and Rumsfeld was wrong to say, no, you can't have those people.
I'm curious, what then, you touched on this earlier, what has the war done to the military?
The war has, the good side of what this war has done for the U.S. military is to give it combat experience. And you have, the next time the U.S. needs to run a counterinsurgency campaign, it will do a hell of a job of it, because you have especially junior officers having all these sort of self-educating, self-informing networks. So it is battle-tested now in a way it had not been before. Simultaneously, it is way overstrained and overextended. I mean, the news reports about not meeting the reenlistment targets, especially for the reserves and National Guard, are certainly true. It's using up its machinery, it's using up its weaponry, and it is embittered at its civilian leadership. There is a clear sense, combined with patriotism, bravery, pride in the mission, of having been put in a quasi-Vietnam-like situation. Not like Vietnam, obviously, in the scale, but where the professional military judgment was overruled for civilian theories. I think that has been embittering to much of the military.
And isn't the long-term consequence here that the credibility of the military component of our power has really been called into question?
Yes, because if you recall back to, say, pre the invasion of Iraq, America's military power seemed to be literally limitless. Anything we wanted to do, we could do. Now it's clear that yes, we can take over Iraq, but not in some cakewalk fashion, and not with anything left over. know, if we're thinking about Iran, there's no troops left over to go to Iran or North Korea or elsewhere. So I think the limits of American power are now evident in a way they were not evident before the power was used.
One comes back to this question again. Do you think that now the people in the Bush administration, the ones who are left, get that reality?
It would seem there are several ways in which, without ever admitting it, the Bush administration is acting as if it has learned some things. For example, in dealing both with Iran and North Korea, there's been a sense all the way along that we need to do this in an allied way, and the Europeans are not dead weight and whiners, but people who we need to deal with, and same with the Chinese and coming to North Korea. Similarly, there's been much greater caution in talking about military options for Iran and North Korea than there was with Iraq. Because of an awareness of, you know, what you would do it with. There's not an army left over. And I think there is even some public discussion of what's unknowable in the intelligence about Iran and North Korea based on the experience of Iraq WMD intelligence.
So there is some learning.
Yes. Yes. Not admitted learning, but demonstrated learning.
I want you to talk a little now about American idealism in U.S. foreign policy. You were a speechwriter for President Carter. President Carter really helped shape the agenda in an earlier period with regard to human rights. That theme recurs in American foreign policy and so on. And I guess what is striking is, for me, is that when you link American idealism with American military power, the key question becomes, how do you balance against the abuse of power on the one hand, and on the other hand, the misperception that comes from a bloated idealism,
right?
Freedom everywhere, for example.
Well, I think that you know, a couple of the points you made exactly sum up the issue. It is a matter of balance, and it's a matter of sort of recurring themes. As long as the U.S. has existed, there's been a kind of tension between, on the one hand, the sort of universalism of the values the U.S. has preached, which spread into the French Revolution and were meant to be an example for people in South America and elsewhere, and a sense of the practical limits of where the U.S. could get into entangling alliances and how much it could afford to do things. And we've seen through our history it's a testing of the limits on each side of that. And interestingly, at least to me, during the Carter administration, it's fascinating to remember how careful Jimmy Carter was in his rhetoric. And when he was talking about human rights, he was not saying we could make this the only lodestone of our policy, we could impose it everywhere, but on balance, we would stand for it. You know, that we'd recognize complications, but we'd always push for this as some kind of goal, recognizing we couldn't realize it everywhere, which is in reality what any administration has to do, even though rhetorically it's not what the Bush administration has talked about. It's talked in much more absolute terms. So I think that a problem for the Bush administration now is the contrast between the president's inaugural speech for his second term, which was absolutist in a way we haven't heard since Woodrow Wilson. We will stand for freedom everywhere, and that's it. You know, that's our policy. And the reality that this administration, like every other one, has to balance that with what it can do and what, you know, just what the limits are of how far the U.S. can afford to impose its ideals on everyone else.
If you bring idealism to the agenda, do you think that initially it wins public support, that you then have more support that you might otherwise have, but then do you lose that support when it becomes clear that when the tire hits the road, it doesn't work so easily?
Yes, I think that the U.S., it's in the American nature to like the idea of being more than simply a great power. We want to think we are a power that others aspire to. We like the idea of being liked and admired. And we think that just as this country can receive immigrants from all over, that our model should be inspiring to people. And that is a deep part of our culture. But as soon as it becomes a quagmire or a mess, you know, there is an equally strong part of American culture saying, wait a minute, why is my daughter being shot to try to bring, you know, let people in Baghdad vote? If they're going to blow themselves up, what are my children doing over there? So I think that it is impressive that the U.S. has gotten this far into the engagement of Iraq with as little backlash as it has had, even though in 2005 the opinion polls seemed to show a clear majority thinking the Iraq war was a mistake.
These events of the last couple of years and the decision we've made, I mean, are a period of opportunity, sort of like the end of World War II, when the groundwork was laid in the form of a grand strategy, containment, right. and the principles that essentially guided us forward. Do you think the administration has been successful in the documents that it has produced calling for a way to deal with the world?
Well, I think to give them credit, by their lights, they've laid out what is a coherent theory, if you believe it. And the first big statement of it would have been that national security doctrine in the summer of 2002 on preventive and preemptive wars that the U.S. had to sort of strike before it was struck against. And then in all the speeches since then with the arguments about bringing democracy around the world, that's the way to avoid terrorism, that's the way to bring freedom to all sorts of people. So it's coherent if you believe it. I think there's a counter argument which says this is logically consistent but practically impossible, and practically not something that's going to be sustainable by our money, by our manpower, by our alliances. And so there's a different kind of theory sort of struggling to be born about how the U.S. can practically and sustainably manage to have a good example and win the battle of ideas in the long run without the same kind of heavy military presence that it's had so far.
You sketched out in an article in The Atlantic some of the elements of a strategy, and they're fairly simple, but basically the policy process as is guided by this administration really obfuscates the possibilities here.
Well, I would not pretend for one second that I presented a grand unified theory, but I was impressed after interviewing people that you could have this kind of triage list, and this strategy starts just as during the Cold War the idea was to contain the Soviet Union and deter nuclear war as job number one. Job number one right now is to contain the loose nuclear weapons floating around the Soviet Union and make sure they aren't sort of spread to terrorists, because that is the one thing that could really disrupt our society in a permanent way. So job one is saying loose nuclear weapons matter more than anything else. Job number two is a more rational approach to homeland security, which actually we're starting to see now with a replacement of Tom Ridge by Michael Chertoff, where they're starting to say we can't protect against everything. There are greater and lesser threats. And then job number three would be, might have a different kind of Cold War of saying there's a long-term battle of ideas and ideals, and making the idea of small d democratic, small l liberal market society be appealing to people over time, not this kind of culture war of the Christians versus the Muslims or the Judeo-Christians versus the Muslims. And there's a surprisingly rich literature on this front of how, in the long run, you could have an appealing example of ideas to the third world, the Arab Islamic world.
Let's talk about the second one, the loose nukes.
Skip past.
Yeah. Well, because you point out something in your piece, namely the goal of the adversary is really fear. And that if you're not prioritizing, if you, I think you said, democratize all threats, then you're helping them accomplish their goal. Talk a little about it. It's very important.
There was a wonderful paper by a young graduate student at MIT named Benjamin Friedman in a magazine called Breakthroughs, essentially arguing that the way Homeland Security as a phenomenon in the last two or three years has actually made the U.S. far worse off than it had been before. And the argument would be that the goal of terrorism is not so much to kill individual people as to impose all kinds of costs on society, financial costs, diplomatic costs, and psychic costs, where people can't live a normal life because they're so afraid. And the way we'd had our Homeland Security service was just magnifying all these things. We'd have these nationwide terror alerts where if there was some threat on Wall Street, then people in Omaha and people in Stockton and in San Antonio would be having to, be on orange alert or red alert, and they'd have to be spending more money, and they'd be fearful for no good reason. Mm-hmm. We were spending money in a way that acted as if the whole country was at risk. We were acting as if, anything could go wrong. It was a Chicken Little type phenomenon, making ourselves fearful. And there, if you had the idea that you would you would scare people only when that information could make them safer and for no other reason. Mm-hmm. Now, then you could have a whole different approach. You would say, okay, here are the 10 things which we think there actually is a risk from. We'll protect against those. For the rest, we'll say, you know, we're all going to die of something. Let's not spend all of our time worrying about it. And you try to minimize the stupidity of, like, airline security screening, where mm-hmm. you're wasting billions of dollars and killing the airlines to acting as if everybody is an equal risk, which is not the case. So there are, fortunately, with Michael Chertoff, there's beginning to be some progress in this, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the third point, the administration has confused reactions to our policies, right. Let's say vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, vis-a-vis Israel, with what is really a conflict of ideas about which there's no doubt. Right. How do we disentangle that, or how should they go about doing that?
Thank you for giving me the chance to make clearer the point I was making earlier. President Bush says again and again and again, they hate us for our freedom, they hate us for our good life, they hate us for who we are. And you can imagine there is a shred of truth to that, and sort of resentment historically. But almost everybody who's any kind of serious expert on terrorism says it's only minorly about that, because if it were really about freedom, the Norwegians would be getting blown up, and so would the French and everybody else. Really, this is about policies. It's about troops in Saudi Arabia. It's about a sense of being entirely indifferent to the Palestinians. It's about, you know, X, Y, and Z. And so it's not a matter of kowtowing to every demand from Arab extremists or from Islamic extremists, but understanding the kind of model we want to project, understanding the things we do which are most irritating, and finding ways to present the right model. Significantly, we always talk about liberty and freedom, which is a less appealing model in much of that world than the idea of justice. Mm-hmm. So standing on the side of justice for all people mm-hmm. in the world might also have some impact.
One could say, in looking at the work you've done over your career, and doubly so in this recent period where you focused on foreign policy again, that you are a student of public education, and you are participating in that process. You've been in Washington a long time. You've been a speechwriter. You've been a writer. You've been an editor of a magazine, and so on. What lessons have you learned about how we inform the public to bring light to the policy debate? Are we back where we were 40 years ago in terms of the failure of enlightened ideas about the policy to be made known to the public?
That is a hard question requiring actual thought on my part. And I guess I will actually wax serious for a moment. I feel more alarmed of this public education issue than I have any time before in my working life. And the reason is two things illustrate to me. One was a phenomenon during the 2004 presidential election, when, according to opinion polls, it's not so much that voters disagreed in their opinions, they disagreed on their facts. There were a certain number of people, mm-hmm. largely the president's supporters, who thought that we had found WMD in Iraq, and who believe that Saddam Hussein had been involved in the attacks on 9/11, things that just are not true, just objectively aren't true, but they believe them very strongly. And so to have these separate fact universes is a real challenge. And similarly, it's my impression that the current administration does not really respond to kind of factual criticisms of its policies. It just ignores them, whether it's about the deficit or about WND or whatever. And so I feel I have less confidence of sort of the play of ideas than I've had before in my working lifetime. You know, the U.S. has been through a lot, will be through this, but this is, on the point you raise, I have a somewhat fatalistic feeling at this moment.
And what I guess, because the final question I want to ask you is, how will all of this sort itself out? I mean, when I went for this interview, I went back and read your pieces, and you know, the power and the drive and the insight that are all there. But now we're in a phase where, you know, the public sensibility seems to be that freedom is on the march, that it was all for the right cause and the right way of doing it.
Well, starting on January 30th of 2005, when more Iraqis voted in their elections than many people expected, there was a period of about 2 or 3 months of better news than there had been for the previous couple of years out of the Middle East, from Egypt, from Saudi Arabia, from Lebanon, from elsewhere. And it's conceivable conceivable. It's conceivable that this is the beginning of sort of a domino effect of just betterment throughout the Middle East. That seems to me not likely, certainly not likely in the easy triumphalist way many people would say. But the press immediately afterwards, sort of in its flip-flop mentality, said, oh yeah, Bush was right, everything's great. I hope that is true. I don't expect it to be true. I think the public, the American public, for some reason, well, they become relatively numb to casualties from Iraq because there's not a draft. You know, there's a small proportion of the public that's in the military, and they are suffering, but the public at large is not. They're not suffering financially because it's been borrowed money rather than taxed money and been distracted by other things. But nonetheless, in the late spring of 2005, most Americans say, by opinion polls, they think the war in Iraq was a mistake. Yeah, most of them now say that. So I think if something occurs to make it more acute, greater financial cost, greater human cost, greater terrorism cost, there might be some more backlash. But that's I think the triumphalism is mainly confined to the press in the short term.
Mm-hmm. And so will the system then pick up the pieces and we'll move forward?
You know, the U.S. does have a lot of resilient and absorptive capacity. I think eventually it will manage something in Iraq that can look like a success, and so we can leave. You know, it might take a couple of years. It might take longer than that. But I think we'll be able to cobble together something that looks acceptable, and then we can go. And the question is what ripples we will have set up by then. They might be positive ripples in terms of more democratizing. They might be negative ripples in terms of training new terrorists. And we just won't know until we see.
Jim, on that note, thank you very much for taking the time to come to Berkeley, be on the show, and we love having you, and we hope to have you again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Harry.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history. Thank you.